So good to be here with you this morning. Feels like old times, to be sure. A couple of weeks ago, I had this nightmare of a dream in which I was to speak here at Zion, believe it or not, and I was in another room somewhere, and the service was already starting. I could hear the singing, and I realized that I didn't have any notes. I didn't have my Bible. I had no idea what I was going to say. And I realized that I would have to just wing it somehow. And to make matters worse, I didn't have clothes that were appropriate for the occasion. And so I was in a panic and was blessed by waking up before I embarrassed myself and all of you and my good wife. And I felt some relief, of course. And then, just a couple of days later, believe it or not, I got this invitation to come to speak here. So this time I wanted to be well prepared, to be sure. And my mind went back to a time, September 12, 1965. When I brought my very first sermon here at Zion as the beginning assistant pastor at Zion. And I was wondering how many people were here then. I doubt if there were any or many. I decided to bring a message on the same theme and not the exact words that I had as my notes here in 1965, but the title is the same, Our Call to Ministry. And if you've heard this before, I can forgive you if you have forgotten it all. So here we are back again. I was 26 years old when I preached that sermon, totally inexperienced. I had just graduated from college a year before with a teaching degree, but I hadn't had any seminary training. And so this congregation gave me my first hands-on training in being a pastor. And now, 56 years later, at age 82, this could be my last sermon here. But I am repeating this theme, call to ministry, and focusing on the invitation that Jesus gives frequently. Come, follow me. And to the first fishermen that he invited as disciples, he said, I will teach you how to fish for people. And repeatedly he invites people, come, follow me, deny yourself, take up your cross, and learn of me. My point in that first sermon was that God is recruiting, enlisting each one of us into that same kind of mission that he had for his first followers. And while we may have different tasks, different assignments based on our gifts and the opportunities we have, the mission is really the same. The calling is the same. And it's not just for a few select people, but we all are called to that same cause. To carry on that same mission. Now, this isn't to say that there may not be some people who hear voices when they're young, growing up. They hear God calling them in a special way to a ministry of some sort or to a foreign mission field or whatever. But if you think about it, God has created each one of us for a purpose. We're here for a reason. And every location where we are is foreign to somebody and native to others. So Our calling and mission is the same. As for myself, I had never experienced any kind of mysterious, mystic kind of calling when I was growing up. In my young believers class that I remember as a teen, preparing for baptism, we were each asked if the church called you to become a pastor or minister, would you respond to that call? At least the boys were asked that in the day, and we were all expected to say yes. But never in my wildest dreams did I ever expect to be in this kind of position as pastor of Zion or any other church. And I'll never forget the day Bishop J. Ward Shank and Deacon John H. Alger came to our house to pay us a visit and to ask, would you be willing to serve as an assistant pastor to Jess Beiler at Zion? And Jess was an esteemed mentor of mine and a wonderful person, wonderful pastor. And so after much prayer, we decided to say yes. In college, I had read a booklet that I brought with me. It's marked throughout, called The Christian Calling by Virgil Vogt, which sort of transformed my whole picture of what the calling is all about. He's saying that we're all ordained through our baptism to be fully committed followers of Jesus who are doing Jesus kind of work, continuing the ministry that he began. There's no clergy-laity divide that pastors, elders, prophets, evangelists are all a part of the laity. The word comes from the Greek word laos, which means the people. The text that I chose for today is the one that Dave read. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am meek and lowly of heart, and you will find rest for your souls. You will find the work doable, you will find the burden bearable, because you are yoked with me. Now, we usually read that text as something that is an invitation to us to just, especially to us workaholics, to just take it easy and go for a vacation somewhere on the beach or in the mountains or something. And there is time and when that is very important for us to do. Jesus took breaks. But his primary thing is to invite us to work with him, to be yoked with him, to learn from him as our teacher. And a yoke, if you think about it, is an efficient way of getting work done well. And so the invitation at this point in time, if you look at the context of Matthew 11, is when the disciples were experiencing significant stress. John the Baptist's disciples had just come to Jesus the early part of the chapter and ask, are you really the one that we were to expect as the Messiah, the deliverer? Or should we wait for someone else? And Jesus is expressing concern about people not hearing, not paying attention, people forsaking, his followers leaving him and so on. So his disciples were experiencing, no doubt, some kind of, you know, time of burnout and discouragement. So Jesus is rallying his troops here with these words, come unto me. And let's note that it isn't Jesus just talking to people as individuals, like addressing Matthew privately, Matthew being the apostle who recorded this story for us. But he's saying to all of the 12 and all of the men and women who were following him, come to me, plural, you all, like we Southerners say. The English in the King James Bible is helpful here. Had Jesus been addressing just a single individual, it would translate, come to me, thou who art weary and heavy laden, and I will give thee rest. Take my yoke upon thee, and thou wilt find rest for thy soul. Most languages make a distinction between plural and singular you that we no longer make, except here in the South, where we say you all, or some Yankees say you-ins, or we say you guys, meaning a group of yous. So he's saying, get in the harness, all of you, there's work to do. The respite that he's offering is not like just a lazy boy recliner, but it is an instrument by which we do God's work together. Much like the one that you see here that was in the fellowship hall for most of the years I was here as a pastor downstairs. It was given by Charles Turner, C.C. Turner, and he explained to me that when an ox needed to be trained to be a part of a team, the ox was yoked to a trained and experienced ox, working together, learning together. And so Jesus is on one side and the disciples are on the other side. Jesus is on one side of the yoke and the Zion congregation is on the other side of the yoke. And that's what makes the yoke so useful, so bearable, and so joyful, because we're not carrying it alone. And I think of Jesus, of God as being like the teamster who is directing where the team is going. And Jesus is about following God's direction, doing God's business that he's been assigned to. I'm old enough to remember teams of workhorses that would be harnessed together for work on the farm where I grew up. We had a neighbor who had a team that did a lot of the farm work, and he could give them voice commands as to where to go, when, what, where, whatever. And so when he said, "Gee-haw," or "Giddy up," the team would go. If he said "gee," they would go to the right. "Haw," go to the left. And of course, "whoa," they would stop and rest, whatever. And this was done for oxen as well. Some who pulled wagons for 1,000 plus miles the west on the Oregon Trail and so on. Now, oxen don't have bridles like horses do, but they learn to follow the same kinds of commands. Gee, haul, go, stop, whatever. So if you think about it, if we're yoked with Jesus in our baptism, it means that we give up our right as Jesus' followers to go just anywhere we please. In other words, Jesus sets the pace and sets the direction. And if Jesus goes gee, we can't go haw. We are yoked together with him in a way that is to our benefit and the benefit of the work to which God has called us. So if Jesus is spending his time with some people that are of poor reputation, we're there with him. If Jesus is spending his time in the soup kitchen, feeding the hungry, or if he's helping the homeless, or offering health care to the sick, we are there with Jesus. Our work is defined by his work and by his leadership. We are God's hands and feet and voices as we do what God wants and express the love that God is all about. Now, in case you think this could be exhausting, it probably is in some respects. And that's where Jesus' words of encouragement come in. I like Clarence Jordan's cotton patch version of the Gospel of Matthew. Clarence Jordan was a Bible scholar who founded Koinonia Farms down in Americus, Georgia. And it was one of the most segregated places in all of the South. And he and his family and fellow Koinonia farmers faced all kinds of threats, bombings, and boycotts, simply because they insisted on living and working together with people of all races, so on, in the way that they believed Jesus would do. And he translates the passage this way: "Come to me, all of you who are frustrated and have had a bellyful, and I will give you zest. Get in the harness with me and let me teach you, for I am trained and have a cooperative spirit, and you will find zest for your lives. For my harness is practical, it's well-fitted, and my assignment is joyful." If we're not yoked with Jesus, we're going to find ourselves yoked with unbelievers. We're going to find ourselves following the demands of Dame Fashion, Lord Mammon, General Mars, the god of war. We'll find ourselves yoked and choked to death by materialism, by militarism, by nationalism, and other kinds of isms that sap our strength and distort our view of who we are and what we're about as children of God. So if we really believe that, if we believe what Jesus is saying, we would believe that if we learn to live the way the Father taught Jesus to live, that in the end it would truly result in happily ever after, in this life and in the life to come. So the word rest is like respite or renewal or refreshment. The word Jordan translates zest. The Aramaic word that Jesus would have used was the word sabbat, which means Sabbath. And the word that Matthew chooses, who writes the gospel, tells the story in the Greek language, is anapausa, which is where our word pause comes from, as in the pause that refreshes. As we keep on demonstrating here on earth the way people are to live forever and everywhere, the way they are to pray and to live out God's will being done on earth as it is in heaven. So there you have it, Zion, a last sermon much like the first, about how we're all called to help create and celebrate a kind of heaven on earth that we demonstrate here as a city on a hill, as salt and light to the people around us that we work with and live with, who love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, and who love their neighbor and each other, care for each other as they do themselves, where they share freely with people in need everywhere, and where they love even their enemies, where they beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, where they learn war no more, and where they experience a taste of shalom that they demonstrate here and now, here on earth, where nothing is marred and nothing is missing, where people are together engaged in worthwhile work and in life-giving Shabbat, in Sabbath. Our bodily rest, Almagene and I, will be in a burial plot just outside this church in the cemetery. Plots that the church graciously gave us as a gift, so we could be buried next to good neighbors like our friends John and Maud Lance, who were such beautiful disciples of Jesus here in part of the Zion congregation. And near Duard and Phoebe Brenneman, yoked together as an important part of Zion's mission, including being God's people for the Vietnam refugee family that we sponsored back in the 70s. And near J.P. and Retha Alger, deacon couple, wonderful servants of Jesus, a blessing to us, our family, and so on. And Ray and Shirley Kirkendall. Shirley, with her heart for children, her own children and many other children that she cared for. And Ray and JP would drive the bus to pick up children all over the community for summer Bible school. And each one of these people made that necessary and helpful contribution to what the mission of this congregation is about. Not just those in positions of leadership. So to all of God's people, past, present, and future, Jesus' invitation is, come to me. And it's an invitation that is much like a proposal that a bridegroom would want to give to his bride. As Theodore Weld, who was a 19th century abolitionist, wrote to his fiancée in May of 1838, "We are bound together, Angelina, not merely nor mainly to enjoy, but together to do and to dare, together to toil and testify and suffer, and together to experience joy unspeakable and full of glory." God bless you all. We love you.